You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You have my sword.
And you have my bow.
And my trowel.
Hi, you're listening to episode 57 of And My Trowel, where we look at the fantastic side of archaeology and the archaeological side of fantasy. I'm Ash.
And I'm Tilly.
And today, we're going to be talking all about The Witcher. So, ooh, spoilers ahead. I know, right? We do. So, Tilly, I want you to imagine a world where multiple dimensions collided long ago, letting magic, monsters, and strange races spill into one land. Humans, they arrive later, displacing older races, while monster hunters roam the wilds, walking a line between civilization and chaos. That's the continent of The Witcher, yeah. And we've been sent to survey it.
Oh gosh, it sounds a bit dangerous. Have we done like the precautionary health and safety measures?
Yeah, for a risk assessment, it's fine.
Yeah, we've got the risk assessment. Very risky. Approved. Okay.
I've got you a silver sword. Don't worry. You've also got a normal sword, an iron sword, just in case. Oh, okay. So we've got double swords on our back, as we want to do in The Witcher.
Okay. That sounds good.
So I want to ask you, Tilly, have you read or consumed any of the media around The Witcher?
Yeah, I have, actually. I read The Witcher. I actually read it first ages and ages and ages ago. I read the first one. And I really liked it, and then was like, oh, I'll continue reading these. But at the time, I think it was like around when I was starting uni, and it just sort of fell by the wayside. And then I just didn't have time to read anything. And then I reread it again at some point, and then the series came out, and I watched the series. I admit I haven't watched like the latest series, like the series before the one that's just been released.
Season three.
I haven't caught up yet because, long story. We cancelled the Netflix account because there was all sorts of things going on. And then
there's no Netflix in The Witcher. No.
No, true. Sorry. We cancelled our Magic Mirror account. And I haven't caught up on the series yet. So I read at least the first book. I think I also read the second books, but those were sort of almost like short stories.
I was going to ask you, what did you think of the Last Wish that you read?
I honestly can't remember the title.
That's the technically the first book,
yeah,
but it's loads of short stories, and the first season of The Witcher TV show kind of did it in that frame, and people were very confused because it's not linear.
Well, but then I loved that, actually, I must say, about the series. And yeah, I think I do remember, because I think I also remember being a bit confused and being like, oh, okay, it's just short stories. But then, yeah, when I was watching the series, I was like, oh, like, especially the one with the princess, you know, who's, spoilers, everyone. If you haven't seen or watched it, there's going to be a lot of spoilers. So, with the princess who is the monster, you know, I can't remember the name. But yeah,
mother.
I distinctly remember that, that reading that part, because that's like the starting story or whatever from the book.
Yeah, it's Geralt's story. It's his child of surprise. And
So it was this whole thing. So, but then, when it gets into all of the parts with the witches and the sort of that aspect of things, then I get a bit lost.
Right. Okay.
Like in terms of the books, but then I watch the series. So I know my knowledge of that comes predominantly now from the series rather than the game, but the books.
Have you played any of the games? Project Red? No.
No, I have not. I think that maybe my husband played the games at some point, because I feel like I've seen it on a screen.
You would have. I mean, there's so many cutscenes and things like that. See, that's how I got into them, is that I started playing. I actually played Witcher Wild Hunt first, one, because I think I was just a bit too young, you know, to play the first ones, probably, you know. So I played Witcher Wild Hunt first, and then I actually went back and I played the first two games, and so I loved them. I fell in love with them. Then I got the books, and then the series came out. Yeah. So yeah, I consumed everything about Geralt of Rivia.
And are the games quite consistent with the storyline of the books?
They kind of are, but then they kind of not. They take elements of the books and then sort of expand them more and more. So you get like side quests, and it's kind of like it's an RPG, so it's an open world, and you kind of go around the continent, and you go to like the different islands like Skellig and stuff like that. But some of it is and some of it isn't.
Yeah.
So it's much more focused on the kind of monster hunting aspect, but you're still kind of following Geralt and Yennefer and then Ciri. You sometimes play as Ciri. I know the newest game that's coming out, which will come out in, I think it's the end of 2026, 2027. So if you're listening to that then, I hope you're enjoying it.
And well done for sticking around and listening to the back catalogue.
Yeah, I know, right? So yeah, and that follows Ciri entirely. But there's different endings to the game that you can get based on your choices. So I accidentally killed, like, I think I massacred like all the elves accidentally because I didn't do
it. It was you!
I know! So I was like, oh my god, no! So, yeah. So the end of The Witcher Wild Hunt, and this is a spoiler for everyone, so please turn away now. You can either Ciri dies, Ciri becomes Empress, or Ciri becomes a Witcher. And the Witcher one is probably the best ending. I think. But I got the Empress. Because I killed everyone accidentally. Yeah. I was too eager to move ahead in the story.
Well, I really like the world. And I think in the books especially, at least the ones that I read, I mean, we've talked about this before, that my, like, world building, I go a lot of vibes when it comes to books. Like, it has to be, I have to feel like I'm fitting into it. I don't need to know all the mechanics of everything. I just sort of fit into it. And I quite liked that. In the way The Witcher was written, is that you just sort of, everything's implied and you kind of learn it as you go. So you are really confused when you first start reading because you're like, what on earth is happening? And then at some point you're like, oh, I get it. Okay. Monster Hunter. Right. Got it. Like, you know, and it sort of then comes to you at some point, and then you sort of get drip fed things throughout the whole thing.
And I think that's the nature of a short story as well, is that you can't really go into too much depth.
Definitely.
So it's quite like, basically, to give you an introduction of the world.
Yeah.
The Witcher is a whole saga. So it was written by Andrzej Sapkowski, and it consists of apparently two short story collections, but I thought there was three, but it turns out that The Witcher was its own individual story that he actually submitted for a magazine, and that, I think that was in like 1983 or something, he submitted this for a magazine.
So that was before he published, because they were in the 90s, right?
So the Last Wish was then all the collection of the short stories. So I think there's about 13 or 15 short stories, and that's The Last Wish is 1983, The Sword of Destiny is 1992, which is strange, it's all the way around. But then there's the five novels, so there's The Blood of Elves, The Time of Contempt, The Baptism of Fire, and The Tower of the Swallow, The Lady of the Lake, Season of Storms, and The Crossroad of Ravens.
I see a pattern in his naming conventions. So the power of one, the power
and
of
two. Oh gosh, I know, it's funny because then the middle ones are like the, but then the other ones aren't. So I don't know. It's also originally written in Polish, I think, as well. So the translation,
so then that probably has some aspect of it.
But as we've talked about, there's also several RPG-based games developed by CD Projekt Red, and then the Netflix series as well, The Witcher. There's also, which I always really want to play, there's a game in the, like a mini game, in the video games called Gwent.
Gwent, nice.
Gwent. Okay. And it's a card game, and you can play it, and you can collect all these cards in the actual game. And it's so funny because you can have something. It's like a running joke of Witcher fans because, you know, you're going through the world, you're slaying all these monsters, people are dying left, right, and center. Someone's like mother's died, and then they'll be like, "Do you fancy a game of Gwent?" And he'll be like, "Yes." And the music starts playing, and you sit down, and you have a game of Gwent in the middle of this like horrible battle.
Yeah,
you know. But the genre is a Slavic influenced dark fantasy, so it blends folklore, medieval realism, modern philosophy as well. So do you think it's quite distinct in its way, or do you not?
Well, it's interesting actually, because I remember when I first started reading it, and I was like, gosh, this is dark, but like in a different way to other fantasy, sort of darker. And I mean, I know my perception of dark fantasy is different from your perception of dark fantasy, but like different genres. But it's sort of, and I find that really interesting. And that's very similar, I think, to like archaeology as well, right? And archaeological studies and research, like the different locations that the ideas first come from are also quite distinct. And I think a lot of people don't really realize that with archaeology too, like how the same broad topic dealt with in different parts of the world is dealt with in quite different ways, actually. And I think that this is a nice sort of analogy for that, actually, because you still have, like, it's a massive world. It's, like, very intense world building. It's a whole area. It has all this background, like you said, medieval realism. So, like, on paper, it should be similar to, for example, Lord of the Rings, you know, or other Tolkien, but it's very different.
Like,
it's completely... Yeah.
It is. You're right. It's really complex. Not that saying Tolkien isn't, obviously it is.
Yes.
But like, it's super politically aware. And I think that's something that Tolkien never quite spoke about.
Well, that's the whole point, right? Is that Tolkien's like, no, this isn't based on my experiences with war. It's just about people who go through this traumatic experience and end up losing half of their friends and have to come back to the real world and don't find their place in it. But it's nothing to do with my personal experience.
Like, imagine if he went to therapy, we probably wouldn't have the Lord of the Rings.
Right?
But like,
I mean, the Lord of the Rings is his therapy.
It is therapy, yeah. He's creating a whole different world. But The Witcher kind of reflects that post-socialist Central European context, and it kind of questions identity and the collapse of old orders. Like, there's a whole conjunction of the spheres, and which is like the main bit of the world that creates this world where monsters, two kind of dimensions collide together. Well, more than two, I think it's many dimensions collide together, and then you get this kind of rise of these monsters coming in, different races coming into the same world, then they kind of close off, and then humans come along and ruin everything.
Well, I mean, that fits.
Yeah, and then you've got your central character, you know, your kind of titular The Witcher character, who is Geralt of Rivia, and he's a mutated monster hunter, and he's sort of that human monster caught between two worlds, but fighting for either good or evil. Now, in the games, you can be either, you know, you can kind of be that morally gray character. Oh. I'd say in the books, he is quite morally gray, but still morally, like, gray. Still kind of heroic in that
honorable
way.
I guess.
Yeah. Like, but his like whole arc deals with morality and like colonialism a lot, memory, survival, and the world itself feels very ancient but familiar, and that's because you do have that kind of medieval realism there, and it's sort of built on the ruins of older myths and civilizations, similar to Tolkien, where, you know, you have extra stuff in the palimpsest of the world that you can pull out of. So
which again really is really complex. And we've talked about this in previous episodes, how like archaeology is also basically a form of world building, and so I feel like that's why these kinds of books are just so fascinating, because the world building is so deep, and that's how we have all that deep history and have that knowledge. But also that means that the way that we interpret the world, like you just said, like, is based on, you know, post-socialist Central European politics. Like, you can see that in the world building, similar to how you see archaeological interpretations of the past and everything. It's very much dependent on political sort of agendas and perspectives in that respect.
Yeah, it, even though it is set in a kind of fake medieval world, it very much feels like a early 20th century modern world a lot of the time too, especially the race element of it. And, you know, there's a whole infighting in different races of people who people the world, and you see that so distinct in the early 20th century. So yeah, I think you've got that as well, which is very well done. I can't believe stuff like this comes out of one person's head. Like, right. I mean, like, how did you do this? Teach me.
Well, but again, it's so ingrained in sort of personal experience, right? In a lot of these places. And that's, I know I keep relating this back to archaeology. So basically, but we didn't really introduce what we're doing this episode. I just suddenly realized, for those who are just tuning in. So our reasoning behind doing this particular, we're doing a two-part episode. And we, those of you who've listened to us know that we are two archaeologists caught in a fantasy realm who are just trying to do our job and get the archaeology done. And we thought it would be interesting to do a little bit of a world survey of various fantasy universes. So that is why we are now on the continent and are conducting our survey. We've done our risk assessment, as we mentioned at the start. But yes, so that's what we're sort of going into, is really trying to look at these worlds and everything from an archaeological perspective. So
exactly. That's a really good point.
Yes. I suddenly realized we hadn't actually. We're just very excited about this. So we're very excited about going. And yeah, I think this is why so many archaeologists love fantasy world as well, right? Because especially, for example, like this one, right? The world feels, it's an ancient world. It's got this great deep history, but it's also very familiar. So like, it's built, you know, on the ruins of these older myths and these older civilizations.
And the civilization that's completely gone. And you do have these kind of monolithic structures as well that were very, you know, we as archaeologists recognize immediately as a Neolithic kind of thing, where there's monumentality, but they're kind of, they sort of hold spiritual energy and stuff like that. I mean, in the games, Geralt usually replenishes his different magical abilities through it.
And
you gain points and stuff like that. Just like standing in the middle of broadcast. Yeah.
Maybe it works. Like,
just get, if I could be less tired, that'd be great.
Right. Amazing. Well, I think we can definitely explore the little world further. Although before we go into that, I think I see some drowners hanging around in our sacred lake.
Brilliant. I'll get out my silver sword.
Phew, that was a close one. Well, I don't know about you, Ash, but I think our silver swords deserve a little rest.
Agreed. While the drowners rest in the lake.
Yes, no monsters were harmed in the making of this park.
Not at all.
So, okay, I'm familiar with a lot of the monsters in The Witcher, but what were they?
Well, drowners, they're sort of added later on. I mean, they're in the books, but they're added in the game as well. So they're basically, they're kind of monsters that inhabit bodies of water. So both natural and artificial. So like lakes, but also rivers and mills and things like that. City sewers. All that. And they are basically thought to be creatures of drowned men, somehow arisen from the dead but preyed on the living. But that's apparently false, okay? So apparently they're actually beasts from the post-conjunction worlds. So they're kind of a relic at the same time.
Oh, okay. So they're not like, because I was just thinking, oh, they're like the bog bodies because you have all these like bodies found in the bogs, especially in Northern Europe, for those listening. And most of the time, these bodies are amazingly well preserved. You might have seen pictures of them where they're like, because the environment of the peat bog marsh kind of preserves them beautifully. So they've quite often been dug up and people think they're like relatively recently killed because also most of them have been killed in slightly horrible ways. So they have like rope around their neck or, you know, a knife in their back or something like that. So I could imagine maybe one of them coming back as some sort of monster.
They're based on Vodniks from like Slavic mythology. So like a water spirit. But their description is often that they're like a naked man with a pot belly, bald headed, probably wearing a hat and a belt like reeds and rushes.
Naked but with a hat and a belt.
Yeah. And then they've got like green hair and a long beard. But what does that sound like to you? That sounds like a very bloated body.
Oh, yeah. Which bog bodies aren't because they've usually had all of the juices sucked out of them.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry to do that.
Yes.
But that brings us onto a really good topic of the world building because now we know from the drowners that we have lakes and we have water bodies of water in the world.
Yeah, true. So what's the landscape like?
Okay. So we sort of talked about it a little bit beforehand, but just a quick overview. The continent is where The Witcher is set. So it's a medieval style world shaped by the conjunction of the spheres. Mm-hmm. And that's a cataclysmic event that brought monsters, magic, and ancient races like elves, dwarves, and gnomes, humans. Okay. They arrive later they build kingdoms on top of these older civilizations. But witches are mutated monster hunters. They roam the wild and they protect humanity from magical and monstrous threats. So the world is very recognizable to us because it consists of cities and forests and mountains, lakes and, you know, water-based towns and things like that civilizations. So it really is like a palimpsest of society's myths, material culture, which is ancient but familiar.
Yeah. And I mean, a witcher then, so you mentioned, so they're a mutated monster hunter. And from what I remember, they're basically humans that are taken as children and kind of turned into these creatures. Is that fair enough to say?
Yeah. So not a lot of the kids will actually survive. Yeah, so they're kind of pumped full of like magic, essentially. Okay. I can't remember if it's in the books or if it's just in the games, but it's called the Trial of Grass, which you have to do to become a witcher. And then you're kind of, once you've passed and you've not died, like Geralt.
The taking part that counts. Wait, no, it's not. Oh, right? Well.
I think the idea is that, I think the series expanded on it a little bit more and kind of added some lore to it, which was like people either they're like orphans or they get sold.
Right.
I'm not too sure, though, if that's actually... I can't remember if that's in the books.
Family-less.
I know that they're sterile event. Like, that's a very huge part of the story, is that sorceresses and witches are both sterile. And it's all about found family and things like that. But they're basically... Witches are trained from childhood to fight magical beasts and protect humans, even though humans don't like witches because they're kind of part beast... like they're very well trained. They also have uncanny abilities like cat sight and things like that. Yeah. But they also train at different schools. So I'll do all the schools.
Well, I know that there's the wolf because that's the one that's on the book, like front cover and everything. You have like a picture of a wolf. So I assume.
Oh, interesting. I've got different covers to you.
Oh, I had one with like a medallion with a wolf on it.
Oh, see, I've got Geralt on mine.
Oh.
Like a man pretending to be Geralt. Not actually. I don't.
A man pretending to be Geralt.
Come on, model.
With like a very obvious wig on and like a wooden sword.
Yeah, and he's got yellow eyes.
Like, really skinny.
He's definitely not skinny. He's a hunky man. But all of mine do. Mine have like Jaskier, which is his bard who is also called Dandelion in the game. Then you have like other ones. You've got Ciri and you've got Yennefer as well. But back to the schools, you're right, there's Wolf and then there's Cat and Griffin. Now I might be wrong in this, but I'm pretty sure the games added Bear, Viper, Manticorn and Crean as well.
Crean, that them, seems very
yeah, like a little crane.
Okay.
Like, much more like, well, this is the thing. I think they're trying to give you an idea of like different mindsets and training techniques.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Sort of related to different things. And that's quite interesting then. So you see, I guess, the relationship with the natural world and thing, if it's like the trial of grass. I mean, I'm assuming they don't just have to like run through grass, but like, you know, and all of the different schools are related to animals. So there's quite a strong connection with like the animal kingdom, similar to like, I guess if we're looking at like Neolithic Britain, which have all these weird burials with like half a swan in with a child and all of those kinds of things, right? Such a beautiful variable, that one.
It's so my favorite burial ever.
The kind of the relationship potentially with animals is like, yeah, particularly.
Yeah. And if you think about it, like Geralt in the series, in all of them, is called the White Wolf.
Yeah.
So he does embody that training method. And I think the idea is that, wolf, like to me as a person, and probably you as well, who is an RPG like player, like Wolf, it's like a berserker. That's what I would think. Or like Bear.
That's
as
true.
Well.
Yeah,
Manticorn probably. So they're like the hard heavies, the ones that come in fast. They Lone might be a bit more nimble.
Well, right?
The wolves might be a bit nimble. Cat, definitely
wolf
nimble.
Wolf is like also running like, you know, like.
Good stamina.
Yeah, can sniff things out.
Which I think he does quite
right?
Well, I think Henry Cavill's one was like, all the time. You're like, stop it, Henry.
Have you seen that video? Which is basically just him going like, all the time. It's like every time that the Witcher goes in the thing and it's just like a 3-minute long video of.
See, I have such an issue with basically listening to anyone but Doug Cockle, who played Geralt in the game.
Doug Cockle, what a
name. What a great name, I know.
Doug Cockle.
He's the voice actor. But like he was just, it's such a distinctive voice and I can't hear anybody but him, you know.
I'm so curious what Liam Hemsworth will be like, which will have come out by the time this episode released, but we are recording this before having watched the new one. So
I've started. Yes.
And what's the voice
I think he's gonna take a little bit of time to warm up, but actually so far the series is probably the best one.
Big claims
because there's much more, like, as much as Henry Cavill claimed like he was a huge fan and he wanted to get everything right with Geralt, and I think he did at some points. But there's so much more magic in it, like the Ed signs and things like that, you know, the signs for Ignis and like magic he's using, the Witcher magic that he has, he's using all the time, which didn't happen in the previous ones. So I'm really, as like a geek of the Witcher, I absolutely love that. So I think it's going to take a little bit of time to get used to him, but actually he's doing an all right job. He's more English than he is generally, you know, Witcher.
And I'm curious, so I mean, you mentioned magic, we've talked about magic in previous episodes and how it would be, it's sort of almost intangible culture, because archaeologically, like, how would you actually identify magic? But so is this world like completely magical? I mean, we've mentioned so many different monsters and everything, so we've talked about like the fact that there's sorcerers and there's these half monster mutants, you know, which are the witches, and there's elves and everything. Like, is it, how magical is it? How much is there of the sort of normal medieval feel of like classic fantasy?
It is largely like medieval, I'd say. Like, it's got your kind of feudal kingdoms, your castles, your cities, but it is layered with that magic. So like you have like Yennefer is Geralt's, well, It depends
Lady
on which
friend.
Lady friend. Many, everyone
Special
whoever
friend.
Played
if we
the
found
games.
Them together in an excavation, we would probably say they were roommates.
They were roommates. No, if they were two of the same sex, we'd say they're roommates.
I know, but that's like, right? You find like two male skeletons hugging. Ah, oh, yes, they were clearly brothers.
Yes, yes, clearly. Yes, well, cool. Well, Yennefer and Geralt, their very relationship has been forced through a genie or a djinn.
Yes.
So there was a wish. That's why it's called The Last Wish.
Yeah.
Is about one of the stories is about how Geralt and Yennefer meet and how they're kind of they're connected, but they don't know if they love each other through real means or if they love each other through this last wish. Through magic. Yeah, yeah. But Yennefer is a sorcerer. Yeah. And she is able to kind of travel between different, I think she had kind of taps into the dimensions and she's able to travel through different ways and means. But they're never quite together. They have to separate a lot to save Ciri and make sure she's okay and all that kind of stuff.
Classic.
So there is like these layers of that kind of folkloric magic.
Yeah.
And then that kind of, I would say high magic, you know, the sorcerers and your kind of traditional high fantasy magic where you've got like Gandalf the Grey, you know, that kind of stuff where it is interlayered in the world building because of this kind of conjunction of the spheres and how it's brought magic into this world.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an outlier. People don't really like it, but then at the same time, they do. You know, they need it. So, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And it said, you mentioned before that it's also quite inspired by Slavic folklore as well. So you have a lot of that. So, yeah, it's interesting. I always find it really interesting with sort of fantasy universes, looking at them from an archaeological perspective. Because as you said, probably if we were just looking at it purely archaeologically, you'd be like, oh, yes, it's like a classic medieval feudal kingdom, you know, and everything. But actually, if you have to incorporate things like magic, like how would that actually leave traces archaeologically and stuff? And I guess things like monster skeletons would be a tip.
Yeah, definitely. And in the landscape as well, like you have leshies and leshins and stuff, which are the kind of forest guardians. You have like... They're very much, depending on where you go in the world, in the continent, you'll find different monsters because of the landscape that's around them.
Mm.
So you've kind of got that evolutionary monster hunting, if that makes sense as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So you find them, water spirits, like we talked about before, the Rulski and Rulska perhaps?
Rusalki?
I'm terribly sorry for botching every
pronunciation.
As you can tell,
we are very good, fluent in our Slavic languages.
Yeah, actually, we should have got Jen on.
True!
Yeah.
Oh, we'll have to have Jen on for a special to talk
about it all. Because
we'll have
Jen
on.
We'll plug Jen's
book. Jen, if you're listening, come on.
But they have, you know, the kikimoras and stuff that you find in kind of Central European folklore. But then you also have the kind of ones that you'd recognize from Western folklore, which is like, you know, your vampires, your dragons, your griffins, and stuff like that you'd see perhaps in a Western landscape as well as a Central European landscape.
Oh, so you see the impact of international, you know, exchange networks and things like that coming
in. Yeah, well, you also have the elves as well. Yeah. And I would say that the elves sound more Celtic elves.
Huh?
You've kind of got, especially, I would say, in the games, you've kind of got distinctive areas that sort of remind you of different places, like Skellig always reminds me of like Ireland and Scotland combined.
And
also, you know, you do have Skellig in Ireland, which is the monastery.
Yeah.
So there's lots of stuff like that kind of pop out. One of my favorite monsters though is in The Witcher 3, which is the botchling, which is a baby.
Oh.
And it like runs around and you have to chase this like newly born monster
every
baby.
Every parent's nightmare.
It literally is. Like it was my nightmare. I'm like, oh God, no, it's the botchling again. I need to do this. But it's quite a heartfelt quest. Like I think that's a good thing about The Witcher, like they're very human stories and you can kind of understand them even through a monster's lens. Do you know what I mean? So they are really interesting.
Yeah. And in terms of humans and like the way that they live, because you mentioned there's all these other ones and the humans came in later. So, I mean, I'm just thinking, again, if we are trying to identify things archaeologically, I mean, I guess you would see that in the landscape in that way because you'd see different settlement types potentially and things like that. Like, how was that interaction? Was it something... Was there a lot of conflict? Was there a sort of trade and, you know, peaceful exchange? Was there kind of assimilation? Like, how did that interaction occur?
Well, there's lots of that, to be fair. There's all of that in The Witcher.
Okay.
There's like the different civilizations and different places are associated with different races, definitely.
Mm.
But you also kind of have that antagonistic view because you have Nilfgaard, which is like the big empire that's coming in. And you... you know, they're kind of, they look down on different races, so dwarves and gnomes and elves. So, but you also have ruins like Kaer Morhen, which is the Witcher School, Geralt's Witcher School, School of the Wolf. And that's kind of in the mountains. And it's difficult because in the books, it's not one of the last ones, but in the games, it kind of is. So you're kind of at a point where witches are dying out because they don't reproduce and the Trial of Grass is so difficult. Like, you've kind of got this disparity. But in the books, it's not as... It is, but it isn't. Like, it's not as obvious. So there's different ones that have fallen, different schools and things like that. People have attacked them. Oh. Monsters have attacked them. But then you have elven cities like Dol Blathanna, which is, again, I would say that word in itself sounds very Celtic.
Yeah.
It's very Gaelic almost.
I can imagine Arwen saying it as well.
it has that kind of feeling to it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And you have... Yeah, so you have that, but then you also have the elves being treated as secondary citizens in like different Temeria, and then you also have them in Nilfgaard. But in Nilfgaard, they really aren't happy with them, probably because I think there's more to do with elder blood and the wild hunt, and there's so much more than you could possibly like think of. But yeah, there is loads and loads of places that show the history of the world and see the layers of the different societies that have sort of crumbled. And as you're exploring and reading the books, you sort of see that. But then in the games, you actually visually see that as well, which I really like.
That's very cool. Yeah. And I love that, again, you have that political implications of history and like people choosing how to, you know, interpret different things, like, you know, whether or not the elves are seen as second-class citizens or not depends on the political history of the particular region in which they're residing and stuff like that, which sort of fits so well with how we view history nowadays as well, and how, like, which stories are told and which stories are kind of highlighted in that respect.
Exactly. You've kind of got that suppression of that's coming out, and Geralt sort of is on both sides, if that makes sense. He straddles both lines because he helps humans. He's kind of part human, but he's a witcher. And even people fear witchers across the board because they're so powerful. And you see that with the elves. The elves are really powerful, so they're kind of subjugated. And that reflects very much our own society and how people are moving around the landscape and how people have been moved out of their landscape as well.
I mean, it's, oh gosh, okay, it sounds like we got a lot ahead of ourselves for this survey in terms of, it sounds like there's a really rich archaeological landscape here to look into. Speaking of, by the way, people moving around the land, is that a group of like otherworldly spectral elves that I see over there?
Oh my God, that's the Wild Hunt. Run.
Ah, God. Okay. Well, we're going to have to cut short this episode of My Trial, but we hope that you enjoyed this slightly different side quest. As always, please do like, subscribe, follow wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps support the show. If you're interested in hearing more, by the way, we do have other shows on the Archaeology Podcast Network, so make sure to go and check them out. You'll find all contact information, plus links and further reading on today's discussion in the show notes.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy, our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht, and our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.